Getting back to the other point that we were talking about, Maharishi, is the does this mean that the people who live the recluse form of life in transcendental meditation would have a hard time living the householder's life because of a lot of reflecting, or do they do a lot of reflecting?
Those who are living good recluse life, it's difficult for them to live householder's life. By the nature of their practice. A recluse is a recluse. Householder is a householder. A good householder will find very difficult to become a recluse. A recluse will find very difficult to become a householder.
But if he reaches cosmic consciousness, does this mean if he found himself in a different situation that would begin to fade, so to speak? If you take the analogy of the man bleaching the cloth but letting it sit in the shade, it's corresponding to someone who doesn't put it to a great deal of activity.
Should I say that over again? If you make the analogy that the man who lives the recluse form of life is dyeing the cloth and letting it sit in the shade, not putting it to a real rigorous form of activity, does this mean, and let's say he reaches cosmic consciousness as a recluse, that for his form of life, of being is infused into the nature of his mind, and so that for everything that he does, he's permanently in contact. But let's say he finds himself then suddenly in a situation where he's in a big city or in a lot of activity. Does this mean that he begins to fade a little bit?
Once it is permanently done, see, the code of conduct of a recluse is such that even when he does not participate in the great physical activity as is prescribed for the householder, even then he engages in a tremendous mental activity. Tremendous mental activity. He meditates and indulges in action. That action does not include the physical action, but mental action is very great. He is given exercises to think that bring such great mental activity that if the householder engages in those mental activities prescribed for the recluse, the householder will just can't handle it. Just as the recluse can't handle the physical activity of the householders, so the householder can't handle the mental activity of them. It's a very vigorous mental activity. It just shakes the earth and heavens. Better not know it. If you can promise me to hear and forget. But hear and forget, because if anything of it remains imprinted in your mind, it won't be good. Maybe some other time.
Yeah. Is there any way that the recluse and householder way of life could be combined so that a man would develop himself in both areas, both physically and mentally, to a so that he was capable of very powerful action in both spheres?
Teacher of transcendental meditation. Householder's life means life with a companion, married life. Marriage is the central point of a householder's life. Some recluse, single, nothing to do with married life, going here and going there and coming in contact with the people, teaching transcendental meditation. That means he is engaging in vigorous activity, yet the activity is not the activity of a householder's life. Householder's life has so much obligation of the family, children, and all the obligations are fulfilled by physical activity, engaging into some business, into some service, doing one's own something. The whole field of responsibility of so many people. Recluse life is meditate and either enter into that vigorous mental activity, or if you want to engage in physical activity, come out and go from place to place, enlighten the people, give them peace, happiness, teach transcendental meditation. This is how the two could be harmonized. Otherwise, they are completely watertight departments. One has nothing to do with the other in this.
Wouldn't it be possible for a householder from time to time to take some time off from his regular activities and engage in these mental exercises, or perhaps after the obligation of his family is over and he retired to engage in these exercises?
No,
why
no,
not?
No. Not those mental exercises can be practiced by the householder, because that is supplementary to the pattern of recluse life. Supplementary to the pattern of recluse life, not complementary to the pattern of householder's life. The whole psychology is different, decisions are different, and the whole stand in life is different. That was the reason that I said you have to forget. Even if you hear it, forget about it.
Well, I'm afraid you'll have to tell me before I'll understand. Besides, how can we choose if we want to be householders or recluses if we don't know what a recluse life is like?
It's better to not know that type of life. It's very difficult to live. All kinds of difficulties are there. Once you leave the home and have no basis to physical standards of living, you are lost. And it's a very hardship, it's a great hardship. Recluse life is a very hard life. Householder's life, all comfort, regular routines, and you have some nice chairs in the office where you work, and you have a comfortable bed at home. In the recluse life, neither a chair nor a bed, nor a home, nor a shelter, nothing, nothing.
Look, I don't believe it's so bad, because you're a recluse and you made that decision. There must be something good about the recluse life.
master. Teacher is the only good in the recluse life. A teacher. That's all that is the center of recluse life. A good teacher. And that's it. Because his life is not his own. He lives for God, and God for him is the teacher. So he lives for the teacher. He doesn't mind where he sleeps, on the thorns or on the rocks or on the soil or on the crop or where. He doesn't mind what he eats. Nothing about any certainty of life except his whole being is centered in the teacher. He breathes with the breath of the teacher. He lives with the breath of the teacher. All his mental and emotional features are as if packaged in the heart and mind of the teacher. He just lives for him, and that's it. A life of complete dedication. And that in a very natural way. If it is in any way made up, then there will be this inconvenience, and there's this inconvenience, and there's this inconvenience, and thousand inconveniences, and the whole purpose of recluse life will be damaged. It's one way centered in the teacher. And it's only one way flow, like a river flowing on to the ocean. The ocean doesn't flow to the river, only the river flows to the ocean. It's only the one-way relationship between the teacher and the disciple and the master. It's only the responsibility of the disciple to flow on to the teacher and live with him a life of complete surrender, complete dedication, one-way flow. So it is the finding of a teacher that is all one good point in the life of a recluse. In the householder's life, all the points are so wonderful and comfortable and good. But in the recluse life, it's only one pointedness. His whole life moves around the master, Thinking, feeling, everything, all for him. And I have been fortunate to live that life, so I know all the mechanics of it. Otherwise, the life of a recluse could be very, very torturous, because there are nothing of physical comfort. Barely physical needs are met, What to say of comforts? It's all a life of complete dedication, no matter. Under the sun, under the rain, under the heat, and cold, shivering, all that. It's just a terrible life from all the comfortable standards of Western living. Even Eastern living. At least there is a shade and there is a wall to protect from the cold winds and the shower of the rain. Even in the Eastern homes, there is something of comfort to at least protect from the impact of nature. Heat and cold and rain and all. The recluse is all under the trees or in the wet caves or some such things. Life in the monastery is a different life. Monasteries are a little bit more protected and all that. But the recluse life is really a life of all. It's completely a different channelization of the whole psychology, of the whole feeling, of whole life.
Could I ask one?
And over and above that, the tests that a student has to go through, put by the masters to see the genuineness of dedication, the tests are terrible. I mean, they may be terrible. If there is any lack of dedication, then one falls in tests, doesn't come up to the mark. And if the dedication is natural, one doesn't feel being tested. It's just a natural thing, there's nothing bothering about. It's a very fortunate feel of all discomforts.
How did things work in ancient India when the young boys would go off and spend 15 years of their lives as recluses? I suppose that's what you were explaining, the Brahmacharya.
This is how.
Well, then how could they, after they've established this devotion to a master, and their entire psychology was that of a recluse, how could any of them come back and be householders?
The training is different, no? When they have to enter into the household life at the age of 25, fine, then they are prepared for it. First they are taken through the enlightenment, and then having been enlightened, then they are given the job, come on, do this. Enter into the household life and carry on the duties of the world. The whole specific training is different.
Well,
they are not trained into the recluse way of life, no? They are students. The course for the students is different than the course would be for the recluse. That was the natural pattern in ancient India. Till the age of 25, they are students. And then they are prepared through enlightenment to undertake the responsibilities of a householder's life. And then they marry, and then they are the householder's life.
Is the one-pointedness of concentration on the teacher or the master that you spoke of, which is the recluse way of life, is that anything like the devotion to God that one develops as one develops God consciousness?
Just like that. Just like that. That impact of the celestial vision transforms the whole psychology and makes one-pointed in the light of God everywhere, even unconsciously. Like that, the same status of the surrender to the master. The life moves with the thought of the master. It's completely the same way. It is a joy, because, you see, that's what I said, if that dedication is complete, in that dedication, the physical discomfort of living, they have no place. Because everything is a joy, no matter what. Dedication means the will of the master, the feeling of the master. The feeling of the master is my feeling. If he wants me to go this way, fine, this is my way. If he wants me to turn that way, fine, that is my way. Just as the remote control. We want this small plane, we want it to turn this way, put this switch on this way. We want to turn this way, put this switch on this. just a remote control, automatic remote control. There we don't have even to press the button. The whole life takes a shape, takes a flow spontaneously. And that's deeply grounded in love and one-pointedness of purpose.
What is the purpose of hardship in the recluse way of life? In other words, if the devotion was there, why must the hardship be there, or must it?
Hardship is the natural condition of living. There is nothing to provide.
Couldn't one be just as devoted under a roof?
But if the master is found under the roof, fine.
Does this sometimes happen? Or, yes.
It sometimes could happen.
Why would a master tend to be found out of doors?
It depends upon the liking of the master.
So it might be from enjoyment that what most people would call hardship. He might prefer the close life with nature.
This was the extreme case of the recluse life that I was counting. It could be like that. Otherwise, as I said, in the monasteries, masters are there in the monasteries, rooms are there, some little bed is there, something, a few blankets are there. So, and then there the life is set. And if the master is not the owner of a monastery, then that is the life of his disciple.
But the knowledge can, the gain can be just as great in whatever circumstance. In other words, the physical thing isn't a test.
Way of living has little to do with the storehouse of knowledge. The storehouse of knowledge may be sitting here or there or there or there, anywhere. And we have only to bring ourselves in tune with wherever he may be, and the knowledge flows. Just like an ocean or a tank, it's full, the water is full there. Neither it has a tendency to flow because of the walls, nor it will resist flowing if some pipeline comes onto it. So if we want to take the water to our fields, we just raise the pipeline to that surface and the water flows. So the disciple has just to bring himself, his feeling, his mind, to the level of the mind and feeling of the master, and then the wisdom is there to flow. And if the pipeline is not laid out, where it will flow?
Coming back to the discussion of the mantras,
Coming back to the discussion of the mantras, when I think of this transcendental meditation technique, it seems to me that there are very beautiful parallels in it, analogies, just in the process, telling us about listening for and following the will of God, in that we sort of make an effort in the mantra, but also we are listening. It's like the idea of singing, but also being sung through, acting and being acted through. And I wonder if that is, if in this we are not being taught in this process something about how to live the will and express God, but without just being inert. You know, do you follow this? You know what I mean? And there's one other thing that I thought about it. In the process, when we get to transcendental consciousness, the idea of having to come back into active life in order to grow is a beautiful parallel to the principle that we must give, we must express forth into this world where we now live, whatever blessing we may get from the Father, from God. So in this whole thing, this beautiful lesson, you know. So.
The thing is, we have seen in our analysis of cosmic consciousness and God consciousness that one does become a good, efficient tool in the hands of the divine. Once the individual mind comes in tune with cosmic intelligence, then the individual mind works from that level. It naturally happens. And that level means the level of all evolution. Because the divine will has only one will, and that everything should evolve and come to perfection. That's why the whole process of evolution in nature. So, we are coming to a level eventually in our development that we will be incorporating the whole of the divine will in our action, and thereby we will be producing all life-supporting influence for ourselves and whole creation. But generally we do not talk in terms of giving ourselves to God. Otherwise, it may be misunderstood in terms of mood making about God. No? The process of development through transcendental meditation means the same thing, that we will be incorporating maximum might and intelligence and happiness of God. We'll be living the light of God. But we do not talk in terms of giving ourselves to God. Otherwise, sitting like that in a comfortable chair, give yourself to God, and yes, thinking about God. It's mood making. So we do not talk in terms of giving ourselves to the Almighty Will, but developing ourselves to maximum. It makes a difference in talking and in the impression. When we say development of the individual to fullest possible extent of his potentiality, and the potentiality of the individual is that he may live in tune with the Almighty. But the development of one's full potentiality is more of a term of modern times. Giving ourselves to God is more of a term of the olden times. It makes a difference. So we use a language of our modern times.